Welcome to 502 Conversations. I'm Brian Kirby, and my guest today is Craig Good. Craig Good, how are you doing today? Is it Mr. Good, Professor Good?
Craig. Oh. Craig will do fine.
Alrighty, I shall call you.
I'm doing
you,
well.
Craig. Great. I have a brief bio on you, and then we shall get started. I'm going to don my glasses so I don't make any errors here and tread quite carefully. Craig Good spent 31 years at Pixar and Lucasfilm before that, where he worked on movies such as Toy Story, A Bug's Life, Finding Nemo, and Cars, among dozens of others. You are now an assistant professor at the California College of the Arts. As someone with wide-ranging interests that include food and science, you've guest-hosted and written for the Skeptoid podcast, and you have been a guest on the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. When his daughter was diagnosed with anorexia, he got a close-up look at how important it is to have a healthy relationship with your food. As the author of Relax and Enjoy Your Food, he's put on his science communicator hat to untangle the myths that keep us anxious and less healthy than we could be. This is not medical advice, but it's informational, and please consult with a qualified medical professional. Let's get started with, why did you write the book, and give me a broad overview.
Okay, yeah. Why me? Why would I write a book like this? As I said in the bio, I've had an interest in food for a long time. I've also had an interest in scientific skepticism for a couple of decades now. And while that doesn't make me an expert in a field like nutrition, it does make me good at finding experts. And so that's what I've done with the book, is tried to express the scientific consensus around nutrition in a simple and accessible way, because people just stress too much about their food. There's so much anxiety about it. Part of what led me to this was I spent a few years writing way more answers than I should on Quora, which is a question and answer website. And when I got into answering questions on nutrition, I found that the same questions kept coming up over and over and over, and realized there was literally a great hunger for good information about this. So that's what impelled me to get the book written. That and the experience of helping my daughter recover from anorexia. That's a frightening thing to deal with. It is the most deadly mental illness there is. And in my book, anybody who recovers from an eating disorder is a complete badass. They have my total respect. So I wanted to help people feel less alone, have a better relationship with their food. And, you know, it's kind of in the title. So the overview of the, you wanted an overview of the book?
Well, let me interrupt. Sure, go ahead. Give me the overview.
Sure. Yeah, an overview is really just looking at what we know about nutrition, the things that you need to know. We dispel a lot of myths. There are a lot of misconceptions out there. And try to boil it down to advice you can actually use.
We'll get into some of those specific topics, but first, I want to ask you, sure, based on your bio with your film career, and now you work at the California College for the Arts, how did you gather the information for the book and evaluate it? And so what I'm saying is, well, how do we know that we can trust you, that you wrote this book?
Right. That's an excellent question. And right up front in the book, I say something that most authors won't say. I say, I could be wrong about something. Rather than give the reader a bunch of facts to know, I'm trying to equip people with ways to find out for themselves how to know. So I cited a lot of scientific papers and popular articles. There are a lot of footnotes in the book. I've got a companion website for people who have trouble clicking on a link in a paper book. So you can find all the links and, you know, chase down any rabbit hole you want. I had it reviewed and read by some scientific experts and, you know, and doctors to make sure I wasn't leading people astray. So I've made every effort I can to be as right as I can, but it's not so much about who's right as what's right. So if the science changes, or if your medical doctor or your licensed nutritionist tells you to do something other than what I recommend in the book, follow their advice, please. I'm not your doctor, but there's so much of this that's just in a common experience for almost everybody that I think the book will be generally of use to people.
When you say generally of use, did you have a specific target audience in mind? Is it written for everybody from a 10-year-old to a 80-year-old, or?
Yeah, it's really a general audience book. I would love to see it especially in the hands of women, because they're the target of most of the diet and wellness industry. But men get everyone gets attacked by it. I've had reports that there are 12-year-olds reading the book and enjoying it. I felt really great that one reviewer, I think from Australia, said that it helped his daughter feel better about her relationship with food at age like 12 or 13. And that's a really critical age for that. And that's the age my daughter was when they got their diagnosis. So that made me feel really good.
I don't know if you can answer this question. Maybe it's just too general. But after you wrote the book and the feedback that you've gotten and the research that you did, why are people so consumed with what they consume? Why are we always seem to be worried? I mean, there's obviously a market for it, and the market didn't create itself, or did it?
Well, there are a few parts to that. One is everybody eats, right? If you don't eat, you die. So food is guaranteed to be a common experience with everyone. And there's nothing more intimate than what you take into your own body, right? So it's natural to have a concern about what you're feeding yourself. Unfortunately, as I say in the book, it's much easier to frighten people than it is to educate them. So there are some very large industries who are literally in the business of frightening you into buying their products. And they're very effective. One of the biggest is the organic food industry. They've spent decades convincing people that there's a special health halo around organic food. Short answer is there isn't. There are no nutritional advantages to eating organic.
Don't worry, I have several questions around that when we get to it.
So. I'm sure we'll get into that. There's also the supplement industry, which is just a huge unregulated monster. But anytime you see phrases in market, I mean, organic is just a marketing term. Natural is just a marketing term. GMO-free is a marketing term. And what those all have in common is they're designed to make you afraid of other foods. I even found a transcript of a talk given at an organic food producers conference where they literally said, if we don't frighten people about the food they're eating, they won't buy our more expensive stuff.
Yikes, that's something else, I must say.
Yeah.
Let's get right into the book now. All right, so I want a healthy diet. What's a healthy food versus an unhealthy food? That's something everybody asks. What's the answer you found?
Everybody asks that, and I'm going to say some things that I want people to slow down and listen, because it's going to sound heretical. There is no such thing as an unhealthy food. There's also no such thing as health food or superfoods. There's just food. Again, a lot of marketing has gone into convincing people otherwise. What there can be, though, are unhealthy diets. And the major thrust of the book is to get people to think in terms of their diet rather than specific foods or ingredients.
And before you go too far, define what you mean by diet.
Okay. In this case, what I mean by diet is the sum total of what and how you eat.
Okay. Going on.
Specifically not something you do for weight loss. We can talk about that later.
Right. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you for that clarification. Yes. That word gets overloaded a lot. So how you eat, the way I put it in the book is, what you eat today doesn't matter. What you eat this month matters quite a bit. So it's really the big picture that matters. And anybody who's trying to frighten you away from a specific food or a specific ingredient is selling something.
When you say that a diet, what you eat for a month, that's where we get these studies. I think something was just out a day ago. I haven't read it carefully. Association of, I don't know if it's cancer or cardiovascular disease, with ultra processed foods. I'd never heard the term ultra processed, but I guess ultra processed are things you just put in the oven and go. And I think what they're saying is there's an association with a long-term diet of nothing but ultra-processed foods.
Processed, another one of those interesting words. I noticed in those studies they're starting to say ultra-processed as if it makes a big difference. But really, all food is processed. You know, chewing is processing. The big advantage of cooking, I mean, we are the only species on the planet that cooks our food. And the advantage of that is it's really part of our digestive process. It makes nutrients much more available. And that's why we don't have to spend 8 hours a day chewing like our primate cousins in the jungle do. I think that the real key to the healthiest diet possible is a variety. And if you're eating what most people colloquially call processed foods, the real problem is you're not getting much variety. You know, most of the world's calories come from three crops out of the thousands that people can possibly eat, right? You know, it's all rice, potatoes, and corn. And a lot of the processed foods you find are, rice, wheat, and corn. I think wheat's the other big one, yeah. And if you eat a varied diet, essentially, you're going to be fine. The way I put it is, the most specific nutrition advice you can get is enjoy a variety of foods, mostly plants, including plenty of veggies and fruits, not too much and not too little. And really, anything much more specific than that is probably coming from someone selling something. So if you get plenty of fruits and veggies in your diet, and you eat a variety of species, processed foods, even ultra-processed foods, can be a perfectly healthy part of that diet. Any food can be part of a healthy diet, which is why I say there's no such thing as an unhealthy food.
If I'm out shopping, I'm looking at the labels and whatnot, and I see all natural, all natural, all natural. As you were writing the book and doing the research, what did you find that all natural means?
It means... You ready for this? Absolutely nothing.
But it's usually in nice font, sometimes italicized.
It's in a nice font, and it's in words that make you feel warm and cozy and remind you of grandma and life on the farm and people with quaint accents standing in fields and all of that stuff. That's marketing. That's all just marketing. The naturalistic fallacy is a very common one. It's where people believe that something that's natural is healthier, but try to pin someone down on what the definition of natural is, and it'll pretty much fall apart. Because they're, as long as it exists in our universe, it's natural. Now, there are things that are synthesized by people that you won't find in nature, but they're still natural. And even the legal definitions of natural can get really weird. Getting back to the organic food industry, they essentially wrote the regulations that define organic and then got the USDA to codify it, which is a pretty cool business plan if you think about it. Let's get the government to put a stamp on this thing we wrote. So they require what they call natural pesticides. Nothing particularly natural about them, and a lot of their pesticides are actually more toxic than standard pesticides because they're copper-based and things. It's all, well, it boils down to a great fear that's common to almost all food fads, and that is the fear of modernity.
Let me back up just a little bit there. So
sure.
We've gone over all natural and the appeal to nature, and we started right down the organic pathway, which has been codified.
It's going to keep cropping up. Sorry.
So organic also is one of those labels that they think it means something because there are specifics to have an organic farm, but organic does not mean pesticide free, which a lot of people just assume that's lumped in there. But what
right
does it mean? Because it is advertised as better for you, better for the environment, and more nutritious. Well, actually, they can't say more nutritious anymore. That one's been taken off the table, but go ahead with that. So it's advertised
yeah,
as better
isn't
for this. Okay. Explain, please.
In general, there are no nutrition advantages to organic because it's just the food. In America, to sell something as organic, it means you have to produce it by a certain set of standards, using their approved pesticides, using their approved methods, things like that. As far as being better for the environment, that's a real mixed bag, and there's one big gotcha that makes it much worse for the environment, which is yield. You lose about 20% on average of the yield from a given acre of land if you're growing using organic techniques. That's a huge hit because pretty much all of the arable land in the world is already being farmed. There's nowhere else to go. So we need to make each acre more efficient, not less efficient. And if you tried to go organic for the whole world, you'd have to decide which billion or two people would starve to death because there just literally would not be enough food.
All right. So we've talked about a healthy versus an unhealthy food. It's not the food. It's a long-term diet we're talking about.
It's the diet.
The appeal
right?
to nature, all natural, that's a marketing claim. Organic,
yep.
They have rules and regulations about the farming, but still it's a fear-based marketing claim. Another thing
exactly.
We hear a lot about right now are superfoods. Super this, super that. Depending on what part of the country you're in, it could have a specific state label on it, or it could be something beet-derived. Superfood. So what's a superfood? Is that anything?
It's another marketing term.
But it's got the word
That's
super
really
right
is.
In it.
It does. It could wear a little cape, you know, it'd be cool. There's so much confusion about things out there. There are people absolutely convinced in their minds, for example, that sugar has no nutrition. When sugar is pure nutrition, your body can use all of it. And they confuse nutrients with micronutrients. Maybe I should back up. If we talk about what food actually is and what it does,
sure.
It becomes more obvious why there are no superfoods. Hope I can do this from memory. Food falls into seven buckets. It can provide carbohydrates, it can provide proteins, and it can provide fats. Those are called the macronutrients because those form the biggest part of our diet. We get most of our energy from those three things. And the protein gets used. Interestingly enough, your body takes apart all the protein that you eat and turns it back into amino acids and then builds the proteins it wants. You do need protein. You do need fat in your diet. And carbohydrates are a perfectly great thing. So you got those three things. You can get hydration, which is a fancy word for water, you know, not being thirsty. You can get the micronutrients, which are vitamins and minerals. And a vitamin is simply a chemical that your body needs that it can't synthesize on its own. So you have to eat it. Some other plant, like we, at some point, our ancestors lost the ability to synthesize vitamin C, which is why we have to eat fruits to get and things that have vitamin C. So vitamins, minerals, and fiber. Fiber is a weird one. We don't actually, there are two kinds of fiber. There's soluble, non-soluble. Some you can digest, some you can't. Your body doesn't use the fiber directly in a lot of ways, but it uses it, one, as a buffer when you eat things. That's why you don't have to worry about the sugar content of fruit, because it comes with, you know, whole fresh fruit comes with so much fiber that it's buffering the speed with which you uptake the sugar. But it feeds the microbiome in your gut. And we can talk about how people are marketing around the microbiome later. Did I get them all? I got all those things. Anyway, that's all food does.
So what makes it super? So what makes a superfood a superfood?
Nothing, really. There are people who think there are, again, it's kind of the naturalistic fallacy. You know, we humans, we like to optimize things. We like to find the better way, and that's a great thing about humans. But you can go a little off the rails trying to optimize your food and thinking, oh, you know, kale, that's the thing. Kale's got got the super stuff in it. Well, kale does have a lot of, has a variety of micronutrients in it. Doesn't have very many calories, so it's not very good for fuel, but it's got, you know, those other things. But it and spinach also have things that if you eat too much of them, you'll also get sick. You know, when it comes to toxins, and we can talk about toxins later too if you want. When it comes to that, it's the dose literally is the poison. You know, there's a safe dose for anything, and for almost everything, there's a dangerous dose. You know, that's even true of water. If you drink too much water too quickly, it can kill you. But you obviously need water in some quantities.
Let me play the devil's advocate here, all right? I'm viewer at home. I'm looking at these two guys. Here I am. You're a regular guy. I'm a regular guy. We're talking about this. I'm the viewer now. I see these two guys talking about this. You know, when I turn on the internet or the TV, I've got a health professional I watch, and they, you know, they're in a nice studio with a fancy coat and nicely made up and a dress. I mean, that's my health guru. Sorry. So I have a proclaimed health guru that I listen to that is saying exactly the opposite of what you guys are talking about here. What's your response? Because I know that's going to be an argument.
Yep. The response is beware of gurus. In the book, I mentioned red flags that you can use to watch out for poor health advice. If you're on a website, if there's a doctor, if there's a picture of a doctor, especially if he's wearing the white smock, and even worse, if he's got the scope around his neck, giant red flag. Because I'll bet if you look a little up and to the right on that page, you'll see a shopping cart. Don't take health advice from any website that has a shopping cart. Just start there. that's a, you know, if someone's selling something, they're going to make sure that that thing, oh, it'll probably cure everything. As another red flag is if a magical ingredient or superfood is supposed to treat or cure or prevent a long list of things, giant red flag. That's why I try to steer people toward science-based sources of information rather than the people doing that selling. We could name a very prominent former surgeon who has sold a lot of snake oil on his television show. And it's kind of shameful, and you can't blame people for getting sucked in by it, because some of the advice he gives is reasonable, just common sense advice. But then if he's selling, you know, green coffee beans or whatever, you know, that day, then suddenly that's the miracle. A study was done on television doctors and how often their advice was right. Most of the time, most of the TV doctors were wrong. It's like 60% of the time. Another 30% of the time, they were sort of right. And then there's a little slice where, yeah, their advice was fine. Like, get exercise. Duh.
The interesting thing is...
Does that answer the question?
Yes, it does. And the interesting thing about this is sometimes they are selling things blatantly, but sometimes I get the feeling they also believe it themselves. So I'm not going to question their belief. Some of them I will, because it seems pretty obvious that this is just an advertisement. Sometimes they seem to possibly believe it themselves. That's another interesting aspect.
Yeah, that's a question or a point that comes up frequently in the skeptical world. You know, not just in the world of nutrition, but people who believe in you know, that they can talk to the dead, or that they're psychic, or that they can water douse or anything. And people wonder, do they really believe it, or are they just consciously pulling a scam? And when you boil it down, the answer is it doesn't matter. The result is the same. People are being misinformed, and people are being hurt by this stuff.
All right. We talked about healthy versus unhealthy food, what diet means. It's long term. But you had a great statement in the book that I want to read. And let's transition into the diet industry. And this, by diet industry, I mean the weight loss industry.
Now we're talking weight loss diets.
Yeah,
yes.
Let's talk about this. Here's a quote from your book.
Yes.
It's hard to picture a field more packed with misinformation, ripoffs, and fear than weight loss. End quote. All right. That's a strong statement, I got to say. So why is it so strong? I can only imagine that it's based on some information you found.
It's huge business. Because almost everybody's worried about their weight. And even if you shouldn't be worried about your weight, someone's going to try and make you worried about your weight. This is an old human problem. I mean, this goes back to Greece and beyond. You know, the Greeks talked about the ideal form happened to be male. What a coincidence. But, you know, young and lithe and all this stuff. So, you know, if you're overweight, Greeks weren't interested. But the other key to this business is they know that diets don't work. Dieting to lose weight is absolutely the wrong thing to do. And I know I just set off bells in half the audience. What do you mean?
Wait, say that again. Let me stop you right there. When you say they know it, by they, you mean the diet industry.
I mean the diet industry. People who sell weight loss products or weight loss programs, they know that it doesn't work. Imagine what a profitable business model it is to sell people on something, whether it's, you know, special little TV dinner things that have numbers attached to them that you can score and feel good about, or supplements that they claim are fat burners. That's not a thing. It doesn't happen. Whatever your product or your service is, you can sell it to somebody who will, if they follow the program and if your program involves a calorie deficit, they will lose some weight. And then they'll go back to eating the way they used to. The weight will come back and you've got a repeat customer. So it's a huge, huge industry.
It's interesting you mentioned those fat-burning pills. I can't remember what they're called, but I've seen some of those ads on TV. And if you look at the fine print, if you have time to look at it, I think a lot of times it says, when used in combination with a restricted calorie diet and a moderate exercise program. So basically, you take this pill, it doesn't do anything, but here's what really is going to work for you.
Exactly. It's for people as old as I am, they might remember the story of Stone Soup that Captain Kangaroo used to tell, where a soldier came to town and tried to get people to feed him, and they didn't want to. And so he said, well, I can help you make some stone soup. So he puts a stone in a pot of water, and he says, well, that's pretty good, but it could use some carrots. And someone goes, oh, I think I got some carrots. You know, and people start contributing ingredients until the stone soup tastes great, right? And they all give credit to the stone when really it was the food they brought. So, yeah, it's exactly the same thing. It'd be kind of like saying, these shoes will allow you to survive jumping out of an airplane when worn with a properly used parachute.
Oh, that's a good one.
Right? Yeah.
So what about specifically exercising to lose weight? So it's not only just diets that get sold. We also get sold these products that, this or that will help you lose weight if you exercise with it. And also, I can exercise a specific part of my body to build muscle. Like I can do a bunch of, I don't know, curls to build arm strength, or I can target a muscle exercise. So we're sold exercise things to lose weight, but then we're also sold them to lose specific areas of, like, lose weight in your tummy, lose weight on your thighs. So we can target exercise. Can we target these diet exercise things?
Wouldn't that be nice if that worked? But it doesn't. Your body decides where it's going to store fat and where it's going to retrieve it from, and there's nothing you can do about it. So the body does not spot reduce. Yes, you can spot build a muscle, because muscles respond to being worked to failure by growing more fibers and, you know, becoming bigger and stronger. It doesn't work that way with fat loss. There are no loopholes in the laws of thermodynamics. So when it comes to weight loss due to fat, it's always just because of a sustained calorie deficit. Well, that's not quite true. I point out in the book, there are two ways to lose weight. One is surgery, have someone actually remove it from your body. The other is a sustained calorie deficit. And that's all there is. And you can't target where that happens. Exercising to lose weight was your question, and I didn't directly answer it yet. The answer is you shouldn't exercise to lose weight. Now, I'm not saying don't exercise. Exercise is important. Exercise is one of the few things that really does help with a big number of things, you know, health and mood and all kinds of outcomes. Exercise and sleep are two of the best things you can do for yourself. But if you exercise to lose weight, here's the problem. Exercise is a great appetite enhancer. So when you work out and you can give yourself psychologically permission for a little recovery treat, right, you can so easily take back in all the calories you burned during that workout in just a little snack, right? I think I burn, my Apple Watch tells me that I burn around 150 to 180 calories when I do my little workout. That's a Coke, pretty much, right? If I just had, you know, chocolate milk after that to reward myself, that part of the calorie exchange has just been completely nullified. There's a saying that you can't outrun your fork, right? It's very easy to eat past everything you're burning with exercise. Having said that, once your weight starts approaching a good weight, if you start in gently with an exercise program, because the big failures come, you know, all those gym memberships that get canceled in February, because people think, I'm gonna jump in the gym and, you know, burn off all this stuff. Everything has to be long term, right? You don't want to lose weight quickly. You can't lose it super quickly, and anything promising a fast weight loss is really dangerous. But you should have regular exercise as a part of your life and start ramping it in as your weight becomes closer to the weight you should be at. It turns out there was a study that found that people who lost weight and kept it off had one exercise in common: walking. Just walking around. So it doesn't have to be going to the gym. It doesn't have to be lifting weights. It doesn't have to be running. If you eat a healthy diet and walk and move around, you've got a good chance at achieving and maintaining your weight loss.
So a form of exercise is good for a healthy lifestyle.
Absolutely.
A robust exercise is not. You can't outrun your diet. I think that's actually one of the studies even. So you can't just count on the exercise, but a sustained calorie deficit is a healthy way to lose weight. And when you say a sustained calorie deficit, you're not talking going from 2,000 to 1,000. Can you define or what you found out about a healthy, sustained calorie deficit? Please.
That's such a good question. Thank you for asking. One of the dangers of rapid weight loss is you can get into disordered eating territory fairly easily, especially restrictive diets. If people tell you, don't eat this, don't eat that, don't eat that. You know, you start eliminating things from your diet. That can be very unhealthy. There are a few numbers. Everyone's aware of that sort of 2,000 calorie a day average thing, you know, you see on restaurant menus and food labels. For an average, that's kind of an average sized adult male average TDEE, or total daily energy expenditure in a day. There's a thing called your basal metabolic rate, or BMR, which is what your body needs. You can think of it as just your overhead. If you were in a coma in a hospital and they were just keeping your body alive and maintaining your weight, that's how many calories you would be burning, you know, at your basal metabolic rate. You never want to eat less than that. And you can find calculators online. You know, a guy like me who might need like 2,000 calories a day, my BMR might be about 1,600, right? That's just my overhead. If you eat much below that, your body can go into a starvation response, which will actually fight the weight loss and can be quite unhealthy. And if you lose too much weight too quickly, then you can get into heart problems and all sorts of things. But if you aim to lose no more than about 2 pounds a week, sort of a kilogram a week, you're even better off at sort of a pound a week. That's a calorie deficit of maybe 300 to 500 calories. So if you're a 2,000 calorie a day person, maybe eating 1,800 a day or 1,700 a day, which is not terribly hard to do. You're not starving at that point, right? That will allow you to just shed the weight slowly, you know, gradually, and you have a much better chance of hitting a new set point. Because your body will hit a point where it just kind of wants to maintain the weight it's at. And we should mention that there is no one ideal weight, just like there's no one ideal diet. There's no one ideal weight. It's generally considered to be on the lean side of a range of weights that you can be. But there are new studies finding that even people who are considered overweight or close to obese actually live longer than some people who are lighter. It's not necessarily a deadly thing or as bad as people think. So before you lose any weight, consult with your doctor. Find out what would be a healthy weight before you set that goal.
And I will also caution people, this is not medical advice. You have to look this up. There's no shortcut either. So you're going to listen to this show. Don't take any of this out and do it. Get the book, Relax and Enjoy Your Food. Read it. Look at the footnotes, right, to see where the justification comes from. There's a point where you have to educate yourself rather than take these shortcuts that are being promised to you. And this show is not a shortcut. You have to still go out and do the research. But let me just caution people also, if they're thinking, you know, they want to go from 2,000 to 1,800, they might want to take a week or two and see what they're eating, because it's possible they're eating 3,000 calories a day with a couple of sodas and a couple of a frap or something. And if they start a coffee mocha or whatever, they may be way over 2,000, and maybe they just bring it down, they'll lose a few pounds that way. And I only say that, it's a personal anecdote, but that's kind of what happened to me. I was just consuming too much.
Yeah.
No mystery there.
It's not very mysterious. That was kind of me. When my wife was pregnant with our daughter, I had a sympathetic weight gain because there was a lot of eating going on, and I got, you know, up around 185 or something and decided to do something about that. And one thing I noticed was, you know, I was having a couple of sodas a day.
There you go. That's 400 calories almost right there.
Yeah, that's a good 300 calories right there. So just switching to water might be all you need. Now, there are other things I recommend in the book, tricks to make sure you get enough fruits and veggies. One is to serve them first. There have been some really interesting studies that if you just have your veggies first, that's the only change you make in your diet. Don't eliminate any food you're like, have your burgers, have your pizza, have whatever. Just have your veggies first. That will usually raise the proportion of vegetables in your diet. And an interesting thing happens there, because vegetables and fruits are, unless they're really good ones like avocado, are very low in calorie density. So you feel fuller on fewer calories. So without making any effort really to lose weight, just having your veggies first, that might be all you need to start ramping it down.
I also want to add one cautionary note about, I know you referenced this study about showing perhaps people that are a little overweight may be better off than people underweight. I know there were some studies a while ago about that, and I just want to caution people that at least in one of those studies, they didn't correct for the confounder of people that were underweight for disease. So they didn't correct for people that had cancer.
Oh, that's a...
So it's true that in...
That would be a major confounder.
Right, and it's true in that study that overweight people lived longer, but they had some diseased people in the underweight group not accounted for. So that kind of skewed the numbers in at least one of those studies. I'm not sure if it's yours, but it goes under the hot fudge sundaes are now good for you kind of.
Right. No, thanks for that. No, I had only heard of this study in the media recently. I don't think I cite it in the book at
all.
And that's good to know. Thank you for that information. I will.
I'm not sure if we're talking about the same one, but. And I tried to look it up myself just so I'd have the reference, and I couldn't find it. But I'm pretty sure what I'm saying is accurate, but I could be wrong.
We could both be wrong. That's the attitude. I mean, I'm sneaking a lot of skepticism into the book and hoping that everybody comes away with the idea that, you know, I could be wrong. And here are ways to find out, right? I think that's a healthy way to live life. Is, you know, not just think, oh, I know this and I'm done and, you know, there's nothing else to say about it. So, please read the book. Please read it skeptically. I encourage and welcome that.
And look at the footnotes. Check the footnotes out. You did mention that you switched from soda to water. This is a great transition for you to talk about some water myths, because there have been some water diets, and if you drink two glasses of water before you eat, that'll help you lose weight. I don't know. I don't think that was in your book, but what water myths did you find?
Oh, man. Let's see which ones I can I can remember off the top of my head. Well, one, that business of drinking water or tea before you eat, that's a favorite trick of anorexics. It's called loading. And if you're doing that, that is a disordered behavior. It doesn't mean you have an eating disorder, but that's not the way to do it. One of the myths is that if you're thirsty, it means you're dehydrated. And no. If you're thirsty, it means your body is saying, I could use some water. If you just drink until you're not thirsty, you'll get enough. It relates to that myth. Everyone's heard that you need 8 glasses a day of water. That myth just will not die. It comes from an article a guy wrote in like 1947. And everyone ignores the fact that even there he wrote that, yeah, people need about that much water in a day, but they get most of it from their food.
Right. I remember that. Right. I mean, I don't remember reading it. I remember it. I remember that. Yeah. Yeah, it's 64 ounces of water, but yeah, even bread has hydration in it. It doesn't mean go out and drink eight ounce glasses of water a day. Not at all.
Right. Now, again, it depends. If you're a Marine wearing 85 pounds of battle rattle in 120 degree weather in Iraq, you're going to need a lot of water during the day, because water's just moving through them, right? They're sweating it out like crazy. But if you're living in a moderate climate like I do, I'm in the San Francisco Bay Area, and my doctor told me, he said, you'd have to work at it to get dehydrated around here. I mean, you just have to be doing something kind of crazy. If you drink when you're thirsty, and if you're urinating a few times during the day, you're fine. You don't want too much water. If you can stress your kidneys to the point of death, if you drink a whole bunch of water all at once, there was that famous tragic case here in California of a radio show.
I did hear that.
Yeah, hold your wee for a wee thing. It was awful. But yeah, it's good to be hydrated, kind of drink as much as you want, but don't feel like you're obligated to pound down 8 glasses a day, because unless you're working out in the desert, you probably don't need that much water.
All right, you mentioned the kidneys and urination, which leads me right into detoxing. Talk about detoxing.
What a segue. I love it. Yes, detoxing. I love I think it's Neil deGrasse Tyson quote that the degree to which someone uses the word toxin is inversely proportional to their knowledge of chemistry. So when you
it's
see
huge,
the word
though, detox.
Oh. It's, yeah. Talk about fear-based marketing. They're telling you there's poison in your body. Living in this modern world, you are accumulating poisons. Your colon's filling up with stuff. It's terrifying. You can't blame people for being scared of that. Fortunately, it's all nonsense. The only detox you need is to have working lungs, working liver, and at least one working kidney. That's it. Unless you've been actually poisoned and then, you're in the hospital and they're chelating you or something to get the poisons out of you, you don't have to worry about toxins. People worry a lot about pesticides in their food, and they should relax about that. One point is a lot of the pesticides like glyphosate, which people think is the devil incarnate, it's only toxic to plants, and you're not a plant, so it's actually less toxic to people than table salt is. But you're getting, if there's any glyphosate still on your food when you get it and that you didn't wash off, people, please wash your fruits and veggies. That'll take care of most of the pesticide problem right there. But the tiny amounts you're going to get are just not going to, they can't hurt you. Most of the pesticides you eat are actually produced by the food you're eating, because plants defend themselves against insects. Good news, unless your name is Brundle, you're not an insect. So those pesticides in your veggies don't hurt you. But yeah, toxins, you don't need a detox. And some of the detox products are actually pretty dangerous. So I would say avoid that.
I love this advice you offer in the book. Actually, I'm going to quote it. Here's another quote from you. Quote.
Okay.
Ignore people who use words like detox, toxins, boost, promotes, or supports in a nutritional or medical context. End quote. And let me just add there, I'll add people that say their product balances your pH. I've been starting to hear something about that lately.
Oh,
balance
it.
Balance your pH from 20 years of drinking beer and eating tomato sauce or something weird like that. And also avoid people that say things like their product is 100% effective with no side effects. Because you know then they're lying. That's like a dead giveaway.
That's just, yeah, that's just straight out a lie. There's nothing without side effects.
All right, let's talk about
anything.
Let's talk about some of your quick baloney detectors. We're running up on time here. I don't want to keep you too long. So let's wrap up with your baloney detectors here. So anyone trying to scare you from a food or ingredient is probably selling you something. True or false?
All right. True.
All right. Anybody that claims that they have the one true diet, is that something to run from?
Run away as fast as you can.
And that includes a superfood?
Absolutely.
What about somebody that's come up with...
I mean, the thing being sold as a superfood might be a perfectly fine food. I like kale, but it's just kale.
What about, I think you also said, anybody that has a named diet. A named diet is a dead giveaway.
If your diet has a name, it's probably bogus.
And again, we're not talking about your diet in the sense of what you eat. We're talking about someone selling you a diet in order to promote weight loss.
Or to promote... anything else. Like there are people who think there's magic in the funniest one is the paleo diet. That's fear of modernity just in cartoon form. But if you're eating the something diet, it's probably bogus because it means the fact that it has a name means somebody made it up. And the fact that somebody made it up means that they think there's a one ideal diet and there just isn't. We evolved as omnivores. We can live all over the planet because we can eat just about anything.
I recently came across a diet that hit a lot of your warning signs, and it's something about... hold on. I wrote it down just so I wouldn't forget.
I think I know the one.
Oh, the
fast metabolism diet?
Yeah, I ran across that recently, but right away, there's the name. But another red flag is it promises to lose weight, lose 20 pounds in 28 days. Sounds... sketchy right there. And also it's one of these alternating foods diets. So it seems to hit a bunch of your red flags right there.
Yes. They're telling you to not eat certain foods. It's important to remember that there's no such thing as a fattening food. There just isn't. There are fattening diets. Any diet that has a calorie surplus can result in weight gain. But there's, you know, I would not be healthy, and I don't recommend doing this, but I could lose weight eating nothing but butter, right? There's nothing fattening about butter. It's just a food. There are also no weight loss foods. There are no foods that promote burning fat or anything like that. There's the myth that there are some foods that have negative calories because you spend more calories chewing them than digesting, you know, some lettuces. They're just very low calorie, but they're not negative, and that's a pretty disordered way to approach your salad.
Some more of your baloney detectors. We've already covered these nutritionally meaningless words like organic, natural, non-GMO. We'll add in there, I think, processed and clean.
Yeah.
Clean diet's another one.
Clean.
I'm not familiar with that until I read your book, I don't think.
So I think I quoted Kevin Folta on the clean diets. Yeah, they're really horrible. There's this idea that I mentioned in the book called orthorexia, which is a word for righteous eating. And it's not a diagnosis, at least not yet, but it's an attitude that you can find. You know, people say, oh, that food's evil. You know, oh, you're eating that? That's orthorexia right there, and it's not healthy.
All right, we've talked a lot about this. Maybe we've bummed people out a bit, but there's no shortcut to education. You have to educate yourself. Long-term weight loss, if that's your goal, it's a slight reduction in your calories, not an unhealthy amount. So there's some work to be done there, both in educating yourself and if you want to lose weight or if you want to maintain a healthy lifestyle, it takes effort. Let's spread a little joy now. Spread a little joy of food and what simple steps you can just take to improve your eating habits. I think you mentioned one, eat your veggies first. Anything else you can give us to end on an up note here?
Sure. Well, One is just remember that idea that what you eat today doesn't matter. What you eat this month does. You know, keep the big picture in mind. Don't worry that any food is bad for you. There are no bad foods. You know, enjoy whatever food you want. Just think about the overall proportion. The trick of serving your veggies first is a really nice one. You can also, if you're trying to reduce your caloric intake some, if there are special treat foods, I hate the word cheat food. You're never cheating. But there are foods that are kind of treat foods. You don't have that often, you know, that milkshake or whatever. You know, that's one of my favorites, that you don't have very often. Don't keep that in the house. You can actually, there are studies that have found that a bowl of candy right in front of you will get eaten at a certain rate, and that same bowl of candy on the other side of the table will get eaten less. Right? That's how easy we are to psych ourselves out, right? So if you just don't have it in the house and treat the treat foods as something you get when you go out on a special occasion, that's another very easy life hack.
All right, great. And what's your tagline that's throughout the book? Eat,
enjoy a variety of foods, mostly plants, including plenty of fruits and veggies, not too much and not too little.
All right. Craig Good, it has been a pleasure having you here today. I'm looking forward to the study in the future that says quinoa, the silent killer. I don't know how long it's going to take.
Yeah.
I'm just joking. I don't think it's going to come out, but I'm not a big quinoa fan myself. I choose other foods. But I know that's another one of those big favorites out there right now. So
exactly. And food should be a source of joy. It should be a source of joy and pleasure. It's bonding. We socialize over food. So just relax and enjoy it.
Great. Craig Good has been my guest today on 502 Conversations. I'm Brian Kirby. He is the author of Relax and Enjoy Your Food. It's well documented. Well footnoted, if that's the phrase.
I think so. We'll go with it.
You do have to type them in, but actually, if you just go to his website, they're all available right there. So you can scan through very quickly and find them. And actually, you can do that even before you read the book. There's just a lot of information from the footnotes themselves.
Right. It's at relaxandenjoyyourfood.com.
All right. Craig Good.
Seemed pretty easy.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
You're welcome.